Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Dr. Drew, and this is Dr. Drew After Dark. Please be advised that Dr. Drew After Dark may contain sexually oriented content and be unsuitable for young children.
And welcome to another Dr. Drew After Dark. I'm very excited today, but before I get to it, remind you guys to keep sending those emails at drdrewafterdark@gmail.com and the voice messages at 818-253-1693. They're good. We appreciate them, and I'll try to get to as many as I possibly can. And also check out the Dr. Drew After, but the Adam and Dr. Drew Show, the Dr. Drew Podcast, yeah, This Life You Live, and it's all at drdrew.com, so check it out there. It's a big opium series, too, where I try to chronicle how we got into this mess. We have it up as an audio book as well as a written sort of chapter by chapter thing you can take a look at. But if you wonder how we got into this mess, we chronicle the whole thing there. It is my privilege to welcome to the show Yakov Smirnoff, Dr. Yakov Smirnoff,
Thank you, doctor.
How are you, sir?
Wonderful. Yeah.
So tell them what happened, what you've been doing the last couple of years.
Oh, gosh. So I got interested in psychology of laughter. And I went to University of Pennsylvania and studied with Martin Seligman, which is the father of positive psychology, and got my master's degree at UPenn, decided that that was enough. I needed to do more research on laughter after so many years performing. And so I got my doctorate degree at Pepperdine University.
A couple of weeks ago,
yeah. So I'm really excited. And my dissertation was called Law of Laughter. And I came up with the formula that I believe is very powerful.
Do you have the magnets?
I didn't bring the magnets with me.
I have a camera here. It'd be perfect. You did it on the radio, but now we have cameras. You didn't do it.
I didn't know there were cameras. That's what it was. But I figured I didn't want to do another thing. You've already seen it twice. I don't want to bring props.
Fragmented audiences are. This is a group that hasn't seen this.
Next time. But the magnets were actually my way of explaining how relationships work and how laughter can be created. And you need to have complementary opposites. So performer in the audience is the complementary opposite. Unless you have a heckler, then they're adversary opposites. Mm. And that's not normally healthy.
Not ideal.
You know. And so that was number one. Number two, you need to meet the audience's needs and they need to meet your needs. So there is that complementary exchange happening. When I tell a joke and they laugh, we're exchanging the currency that is important to us and why we're doing this. And number three, we need to have shared sense of humor. So my humor can go over their heads and it won't work. Mm-hmm. And or if it's too low, it doesn't work. So it needs to be on their level, and their understanding of what I'm talking about is paramount to that. And that equals laughter. So those are three ingredients: that complementary opposites, needs being met, and shared sense of humor.
And this not just goes into an audience, a comedian relationship, it goes into romantic relationships.
A romantic relationship where I started this process trying to understand how does it work, because I noticed the correlation between the beginning of the relationship, and I thought it was just me, but then I started asking my audience and they all remember a lot of laughter in the beginning of the relationship, and then later on laughter kind of fades away, but they don't pay attention to it because comedians are trained to listen. If there is a nuance that didn't make the joke as good as it should be, we register it immediately, and next show we will fix that.
Is that a fixing with the language or with the rhythm or with all kinds of things?
Could be that it's a reference that they didn't get, could be the rhythm, could be anything. Timing is a big deal. Yeah. So once in a while, you just take a pause for another half a second, and it gets a big laugh. And then you go, okay, that's what I'm going to be doing for next whatever amount of years when I'm going to tell that joke.
And in relationships, is it more spontaneous? What's going back and forth? I've noticed women very much seek somebody who makes them laugh.
Yes, they do.
Men do a little bit. I'm not sure they put as much currency in as women.
They want to make women laugh. Women's laughter are what men are after, because if we can get them to laugh, we can get them to do a lot of other things. So we go after it, and we hear that laughter. It makes us, you know, go, well, that just reassurance that we're on the right track,
right,
to where we want to go.
And then once there is a relationship, your idea of there being a
shared humor could stay, because humor doesn't change normally. Your wife and you have the same sense of humor when you met, and hopefully for many, many years to come.
And that's built on culture and circumstance and
a lot of elements that go into that. It's level of intelligence. There is level of references. There are many different things, but that creates that humor that is shared. And when you find that person, you literally, I mean, it's like I tell in my show, I say that dating, you know, people, when you start dating, they say there's plenty of fish in the sea, but also, there are sharks and there are piranhas,
right,
and you don't want to end up with crabs. So
they're there too.
Yeah, so you need to find a way. So it's kind of catch and release program. So you're dating somebody, and the first date, I asked this question over 4.5 million people in my theater in Branson, Missouri, and I asked them, how many of you would go on the second date if you didn't have laughter on the first date? And silence, no one. And I'm saying, you realize that you were picking your partner based on whether there's laughter or not.
Women realize it. I don't think men do.
I think men, if they didn't get a laugh from a woman, they're probably going to be concerned about doing that again.
I agree. But I'm not sure they would frame it quite the same way.
Probably not.
Unless somebody asked them to frame it that
correct.
Way.
Correct. Yeah. They don't necessarily pay attention to
exactly.
it, but they feel it
exactly.
if it's not there.
Yes. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So you grew up where?
Grew up in the former Soviet Union.
Where?
I grew up in Odessa on the Black Sea.
Chernobyl now, so...
Let's talk about that. That's
really?
Not going to be funny. Yeah, yeah.
Because I that geography is emblazoned in my head right now because
yes.
of where the winds
yes.
were blowing the radiation.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. I actually went to Chernobyl 3 years ago and spent half a day there exploring with the Geiger counter.
I was going to say I would not go in there without a Geiger counter.
I did have a Geiger counter and a guide who goes there every day. So I figure if he doesn't have a third eye or some kind of a strange
lymphoma,
thing, then and it seemed like he's a young guy, so he would not jeopardize his virility. Mm. But who knows, for a buck.
Yeah.
So I went and I figured, well, let's give it a try. So the radiation level was in where we were going similar to what it's like in Kiev, which is... There is radiation all over, but it's just very, very, very small dose. Mm. If we're in the airplane, it's higher. When you're in the dentist office, obviously they take x-rays, it's higher. So we get enough of that. But if the exposure is too high, then you die or you get sick. So I was very, very careful, but it was fascinating because it was kind of like watching... collapse of the Soviet Union in slow motion in that city because they tried to cover everything up. They couldn't get away with it. They had to admit that this is what happened, and then they had to fix it. And it probably was the nail in the coffin of the Soviet Union because it happened in 89, and then the Soviet Union was gone by 91.
Wow, that's interesting. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
And you were gone when?
I left in 77.
Why'd you guys leave?
I started performing on the cruise ships on the Black Sea.
How old were you?
I was 24.
What was it like growing up in Odessa?
It was, I mean, I didn't know any better. So we lived in the communal apartment, nine families in one apartment, shared one kitchen, one bathroom for 20 people, and no phone, no car, none of those things. And everybody thought that was normal. That was normal life. And I tell a joke in my show that when my parents wanted to make love, they would send me to look out the window because we lived in the same room for 26 years.
Oh, my God.
And then, you know, my dad would say, so what do you see in the window? I said, our neighbors making love. And he said, how can you tell?
Their son looking out at me.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So I was living in that. But I also, what was beneficial for my comedy, Odessa is still considered the capital of former Soviet Union in humor. It was a free port before the revolution. And so there was a lot of people from different cultures came to that city. And somehow they created a lot of humor. Mm. So even in the suppressed environment of the Soviet Union.
Belarus?
Is it? No, this is Ukraine.
Ukraine. Okay.
Ukraine. All right. In the Soviet Union environment where everything, I was a comedian later on, but as a kid, I would just memorize a lot of jokes. I wasn't into athletics much.
Where'd you hear them?
From friends who you trust.
You had no records or anything like that?
Well, they had it on the radio like once a week. They would have, or maybe twice a month, a specific comedian, Arkady Rykin was his name, and he was very funny, very famous, and so everybody was glued to their radios to hear some humor that was, you see, because we're all censored, we were censored by the Department of Jokes. This is true.
There's a Department of Jokes?
Yes. Minister of Culture of every state in the Soviet Union had the Department of Jokes.
Oh, my God.
And it was part of Ministry of Culture, so it would be like Department of Poetry, Department of Humor. They had to control every little thing. This is what Americans don't realize, that this political correctness is taking us in a very familiar place to me, because once a year I had to submit all my jokes, then the government, some bureaucrat, would have to, would go over it and tell me, this is not funny. This is not funny. This is not going to work. And that's how, and we had to stay with the script. We could not talk about politics, government, sex, and religion. The rest, they said, is fine.
What's left?
Nothing. Yeah. Buttons and fish and I don't know, mother-in-law
joke.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was our restriction. That's the environment that brought, you know, socialism to the Soviet Union, and the rest is history. I mean, 40 million people dead to get to that place because they had to clear the slate. So people who wanted to be politically incorrect, they had to be destroyed.
Anybody that had any interesting ideas or anything other than the party line?
That's it. The party line, and it was controlled from every angle. No religion. They destroyed all the churches, burned them, killed all the priests, and then they had the state basically giving you the dogma that you're going to follow, and there was no way out.
It's the first time I'm hearing this, that it sounds to me like almost a religion, the way they were. I
mean, they created Lenin as God,
yeah.
And Karl Marx was the one that originated.
So Moses.
Kind of, yeah. They put them on the pedestal. And I remember standing in line to Lenin's mausoleum.
Where he was embalmed,
yeah.
Dead under
yeah.
glass.
And I stood in line for 7 hours. And my heart, as I was walking, I still remember that. I was probably 18 years old because I was going to see God. I mean, that's how they embedded it in our heads.
And so you went on a cruise ship.
Yes.
To do comedy.
So I go to do comedy. And that's where I started kind of recognizing something about America, because they're normally their ships, they were pretty good ships, but they would lease them to like European companies or some Western companies. Somebody will lease them for about 9 months, and then they would bring them back, those ships, to refurbish them. So during that time, they would go on the Black Sea. And we were not allowed to go outside of the country. But on the Black Sea, I was able to, because I was a comedian and master of ceremonies, they would give me an interpreter. And that's how I would communicate with people from other countries, right? Because I was preparing like an evening, like Miss Cruise or some kind of a talent show. I needed to communicate with them. Otherwise, in my whole life, I never been exposed to foreigners, and it was forbidden for us to talk to foreigners. If you were talking to a foreigner, you pretty much going to be arrested. That's how.
By whom?
By the KGB. KGB, the secret police, whoever.
Did you assume all other countries were run like this?
Of course I did. I didn't know any better. And on television, they kept saying, you know, there are two channels. Channel one is propaganda, and channel two is a KGB officer tells you to turn back to channel one. So you really didn't have much choice. You're just used to it, right? Yeah. So then I go on a cruise. Now, first thing happened as when I got on the cruise, the audience liked me, and I was taking that cruise as kind of an exchange for a vacation. So it was a week cruise. I did, I guess, a good job because they asked me to go back again.
Who were the foreigners on the
There was some from Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia,
so
Poland.
How many translators did you have?
Like four or five. But
like repeating whatever, like with the earpieces in? Or
I would meet with the group, with interpreter.
I see.
And I would share with them what we're doing. But it also gave me contact with the people, and I could see spark in their eyes that I never seen before. This is so bizarre. These people are happy. They're smiling. They're dancing. They're taking pictures. Soviets are like so suppressed, and they're looking around and not sure who's going to get them. So here is this group, and then some Americans were on the ship, and Australians and so. But anyway, what happened is when I finished that week, I went to the office of the official office that hired me to do this, and I said, they're asking me to go again, and I would like to ask if I can bring my parents and get them a cabin. And the guy literally said, get the hell out of here. What do you think? You're indispensable? We have thousands of people like you. You'll never work with this company again. That literally, and I was
because
like...
Because you asked about the parents.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. And so I kind of put my head down the way, you know, and I went home and I told my parents it didn't work out. And we were used to that. It would be strange the other way. And so then about 2 hours later, the messenger comes, because we had no phone. So it was like, messenger comes and gives us two sets of tickets, one for me and one for my parents. And I'm shocked. I'm like going, this never happened. I never heard it happen, that they would go back on their word and do something like that. So we go on the ship, and I go to a cruise director, and I said, you got to explain this to me. I don't get this. What happened? And he said, well, this ship being leased to a lot of foreign companies, and they're capitalists. And they believe that if the person is more talented, they should be rewarded. So there is how you got. So the captain told the office, the officials, that even if he has to give up his own cabin, he would do that because I would be really good for this cruise. Mm. And I'm like going, wait, slow down. Are you saying that if I'm more talented in another country, I would have more things like my own bedroom, a phone,
place for my parents to have sex?
Yeah, exactly. And he goes, yeah, that's what America or that's what other countries do. And that's planted right away, that planted the seed. And then I learned that Jimmy Carter made a deal with the Soviet government because they were starving. They were running out of wheat. And Americans had tons of wheat. So we were exchanged basically for wheat. And so I see a Wonder Bread truck every time. I salute because, you know, might have been that what got me out.
Wow.
And that's, we applied for a visa. Took a long time, 2 years to wait. It was a very difficult, challenging time, but we came to America.
With your whole family?
Yes.
So you got them all out?
Yeah. Well, that was another...
Were you immigrating or were you...
We were refugees.
Refugees.
But here's... What's interesting that the Soviets didn't want people out, even though they wanted wheat.
Yeah.
But they didn't want the rats to leave the ship.
Yeah.
And so so they made some policies that were very difficult to go around. Like, for example, if a young person wants to leave, he has to take his parents.
Hmm.
Right?
Interesting.
And that was... So most older people didn't want to leave.
Right.
It just, I was lucky that my dad, being since I was a little kid, he was like, we got to get out of here. We got to get out of here.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
My mom was scared to death. And so it was like one of those things. And my dad was an inventor, very creative, very, but mom was in charge. And so I was the tiebreaker.
Huh.
And so when I came from one of these cruises, I said, we got to go. We got to go. My mom, you know, wanted to, you know, kill my dad for putting that thing in my head. And
was she happy when she got over here?
Yeah. Well, not right away because, you know, she was kind of, she didn't speak English.
Did you speak Russian or Ukrainian?
No, we spoke Russian. We knew Ukrainian, but we spoke Russian.
Yeah.
And we came here and we didn't speak English. So it was challenging for her. And then it was kind of depressing to her that she used to have a role there. She would go to bread line for several hours, then she would go to milk line for several hours. And it was normal pattern for the government, for us to have. Here she said, I come here and I can go in the supermarket and I can buy everything for a week in an hour. And she said, what am I gonna do the rest of the time?
Wow.
And I said, Mom, there is DNV. You can go and stand in line all day long and then do it again next day. And the next day, so she was feeling relieved.
And when did you realize you had this potential to do what Americans thought were Russian humor? Or how do we describe what...
I don't know.
What your career became. No, you know what I mean?
Russian comedian, yes.
But you saw, you played a Russian that Americans thought was a Russian, right? Isn't that sort of...
I guess I played, I was me. I was me coming from the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
It hit the nerve for Americans because Americans had a headache from the Soviet Union for 50 years with the nuclear weapons and hiding under the desks and like that would help. And then here I come, and they were introduced to Russia with Brezhnev with one eyebrow and, you know, Khrushchev banging on the podium saying, we will bury you without any shots fired, you know, all of that. And they saw me, and they saw me on national television, and I'm likable and I'm funny. And Americans kind of went, we're afraid of this. Basically, that's what happened. And they embraced me. It was like I was that guy who helped. And then I got a call from the White House after I did Tonight Show. And they said, we'd like you to go to Washington and perform in front of the Bushes.
Wow.
Yeah.
This was first Bush.
Yes, yes. And I'm thinking Bush might be performing in a different environment, like, you know, like flashing, you know. That's my brain. And I go, this will get me arrested. And they said, no, we need to come here to perform in front of President Reagan's cabinet.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, well, it's better than the bushes. This way, at least I made it inside, right?
God.
So I go there, and they introduce me to the president.
Reagan.
And he immediately, when they said, this is Yakov Smirnov, Russian comedian, he smiled and he said, have you heard this joke? And he tells me a Russian joke. He was collecting them. So I was like, so he tells me a joke about the Russian guy who wants to buy a car. And it took forever in those days to buy a car in the Soviet Union. So he goes to a factory and the manager said, put your name on the list, come back in 20 years, pick up the car. The guy said, do I come back in the morning or in the afternoon? And the manager said, what's the difference? 20 years from now. The guy said, the plumber is scheduled to come that morning. So I cracked up. I didn't expect this joke to be so funny. And then it was a small dinner. There was like 18 people at that dinner. And
were you freaking out?
I was.
Yeah.
I totally. Actually, I was freaking out right after that. Because once he left and Nancy left, then my hands start shaking. I was like, what just happened? Because I spent 2 hours with him telling jokes. And everybody else were laughing. And they were participating in this exchange.
Who was at the table? Like Kissinger and...
No. Kissinger wasn't there. No, it was... Baker was the secretary.
James Baker.
Yeah. And then it was a French, not prime minister, but
ambassador.
And there were several other big dignitaries from the cabinet. And so they were laughing. But it was interesting also that night, President Reagan sent a military helicopter to Libya to show off Gaddafi that we have power. And so behind the president for the whole evening stood a Marine with the football, which is the controls
case,
for the nuclear.
Wait, so this was the night that they attacked Libya. They bombed Libya.
They didn't. No. This was before. They just sent helicopters first.
I see.
Just sent to show. But still, it was like watching behind the president, this stern-looking Marine, and I'm trying to tell jokes.
Oof.
And I'm thinking, if I bomb, he might bomb. And then I'm going to be responsible for
this meeting.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was when he left, it was like, oh my God, what just happened? This was like, and then since then, you know, there was a great relationship. I mean, they would request for me to come to the White House, share some jokes. This was like, it was like his secret weapon, really.
Yeah.
You know, he could tell jokes to the president of Russia and get away with telling him stuff that he couldn't say otherwise.
Like,
you know,
Gorbachev was this?
Yeah, Gorbachev. When he met with Gorbachev.
Did the Chernobyl, do you think, adequately portray what it was like there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so. I believe they did a really good job, except for English accents.
Right, everyone had English accents. That was weird, too.
That was weird. But the rest of it was very well produced and accurately documented, in my opinion.
Is the city still empty?
There's no one there.
What's it called? Privyet or something?
Yeah, Privyet is next to Chernobyl. Yeah. Nobody's there. We were there like ghost town. We were just two of us walking. I actually filmed some stuff. I can send you.
I'd love to see it.
Put that in.
Yeah, we'll put it up.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be great. And so you keep going. You end up with your own theater in Branson.
Well, that wasn't that easy. What happened is I was doing very well in Vegas, Atlantic City, Reno, Tahoe, living in Pacific Palisades, $2.5 million home. I was
Could you believe it?
I could.
Mind-boggling.
I was living American dream, like high on the hog. I mean, as they can be. And then the Soviet Union collapses. And nobody warns me, right? No phone call saying, hey, you should consider income averaging, you know? No one. And I didn't see the writing on the wall, on the Berlin Wall. There's probably Yakov, get another job. No. Nothing. So I get to and David Letterman has a top 10 list on the night of the collapse of the Soviet Union. I make number one on the list. Yakov Smirnov will be out of work. And I thought it was funny. But 6 months later, it wasn't. None of my contracts were renewed. And I, for years, I couldn't understand what, why. Was I not funny anymore? Well, what happened is I was like the aspirin from a headache. Mm. Once you're done with a headache, you don't need aspirin.
Right, right, right.
So I was kind of put on a shelf, and I couldn't get a job. Literally, clubs, even no casinos, clubs would not hire me. So I started looking for a place where they did not know that the Soviet Union collapsed. That's how I ended up in Branson, Missouri.
Oh, my gosh.
They still don't know.
They still don't know.
No, and I'm not telling.
Did you know that that was a region you could head into where people would show up?
I had...
One of the Osmond brothers tell you to show up there?
Actually, Willie Nelson did. Willie Nelson did. Between smoking their pops,
which is
right.
which is rare to catch a breath.
exactly. So he invited me because my agent was like going, I don't have any work for you, but Willie Nelson has this Farm Aid concert, and he would like you to be a co-host. So maybe you should go there. And I said, well, I don't have any other place to go. Yeah, I'll go there. And I'm thinking, who would know me in Ames, Iowa? You know, nobody would know me in Ames, Iowa. And Willie Nelson introduces me, 40,000 people in the stadium. And he introduced me and they gave me standing ovation. Wow. I'm like, you serious? This is, I couldn't believe it. So I guess television helped.
Yeah.
And so I told them, you know, I said, I know nothing about farming. You know, I had one experience on the farm in America. The guy played practical joke on me. He let me milk his bull. And I learned something. You milk this animal once, you have a friend for life. And they just loved it. And so that's, and then after the Farm Aid concert, Willie invited me to his trailer, and I just have to like go, whoo.
Yeah.
And he goes.
It's that trailer he took all over the country.
Probably, same one. And so he was saying, hey, kid, I think you'll do well in Branson. Wow. He was in Branson during that time, and they didn't really care for him because he smokes, and he wasn't signing autographs, and he was just kind of a rebel for that community. But he said, but I think you'll fit right in. And I did. And
how long were you there for?
Huh?
How long were you there for?
20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you left it? Or?
I actually still own the theater. It's a 2,000-seat theater. There's other entertainers like Acrobats of China, other...
But what led to you going to get the PhD and the master's?
I started with my divorce. Uh-huh. I needed to figure out what happened because, and then I noticed the correlation between laughter and happiness and relationship, how laughter can be a gauge. And if people could get this, please listen for laughter in your relationship because laughter is the first thing that happens when you meet someone. On the first date, and I have pretty good sample of 4.5 million people agreeing to that, right? So second thing happens is intimacy. Third thing, you move together, you live together, and then when things don't go well, laughter is the first thing to go. Mm. Second thing is intimacy. Third is your house. So pay attention
to the laughter stamp.
Exactly. It's like a finger test for your prostate, you know? You need that. Not that you enjoy it, but maybe
bad. It's more like checking the stool for blood after the prostate test. I think it's a little closer. But it's the right zone. Now, back to the show. Well... So with that in mind, we're going to show you some videos and we'll see if we'll get some mirth going here.
Okay.
And we have some kind of serious questions and we'll get to those.
Okay.
Too. So first, and these guys in the peanut gallery will in the back room here that were laughing at
yes.
you. Nadav, he will have something to say about this, no
doubt. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So so this was a hiker that got rescued.
74 years old.
Yeah, 74-year-old woman. Uh-huh. So she got rescued by this helicopter. And so, you know, this starts to kind of spin out of control, and we'll see how
you're
it
goes. Funny.
No pun intended,
you're
right?
You're funny. So she's coming up in that basket.
Oh, spin. My. Oh, my.
So they're trying to get this the spin.
Stabilized, yes. Yes.
Definitely passed out by now.
So this thing, she's passed out. With the, and it goes and goes and goes and goes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's good. That's a, like something an astronaut would have to go through.
Take off. Good.
74? Did she
old.
Survive this whole thing?
She did. I guess take.
Slow that down.
So allegedly she arrived at the hospital in stable condition.
And not only that, said it wasn't that bad.
Huh. So it was like a Disney World ride.
She must have been laughing. It must have been mirth that got her through there.
Wow.
Yeah, I would have thought it would have, for an 84-year-old, you would have think the I mean, it's centrifugal force, right?
Oh, wow, yeah.
So it's going
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it wasn't as bad. Maybe she's closer to the center than we realize. That looks terrible.
Well, it's probably she was lost, right?
Yes.
So this probably was better.
Yes.
Than
it was better.
Than dead.
Than dead in the desert.
Exactly.
There with
cactuses. Yeah. Yeah.
Cacti.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a little video to warm us up with. Let's get some voice messages in here. So these are people just asking us questions. I never know what they're going to throw at me.
Okay.
So if you've got any of a psychological nature, that would be good for Jakob too. So here we go. And I'll do the other ones. Here we go. I saw him hesitate on this one, so it scares me.
Oh.
Hey, Dr. Drew. This is Bo from Kansas.
Hey, Bo.
I was wondering if you could maybe tell me what's wrong with my mom. I know it's a lot harder than that, but my mom, when she gets upset at me, she goes back to past issues with my dad and my dad's side of the family. And she always resorts to saying that she's going to kill herself or she wishes she was dead and stuff like that. And then
was she picked up? Was she picked up by a helicopter by chance?
Was she spun by a helicopter, more importantly? Yes, good question.
Like that. And then the next day she's completely fine. And then one little thing will happen, like me posting a picture of my dad and grandpa for Father's Day. Will trigger her, and she goes back to living in the past and saying that she wants to die again. Really need your help here, Dr. Drew. She's driving me crazy. Thank you.
All right. That's a great question. That's actually a very serious question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So she has, and you've studied psychology, mm-hmm. so she has some pain left over from that relationship loss.
Mm-hmm.
He is a living representation of that, whatever it is she lost, right? Mm-hmm. So she gets triggered. She has she's unstable emotionally, so she's triggered easily. And she has sort of a, I think about sort of a borderline kind of process, mm-hmm. you know, where people have these very unstable identities and they can just collapse into these heavy emotions
yes.
and become very self-destructive in those moments. So there's something, you know, of a personality that maybe going on with her, but ultimately it's about loss, wouldn't you say? And she's not really properly come to terms with it.
It sounds like it. I yeah. like when my dad passed away, I moved my mom. They lived here in Los Angeles, and I moved my mom to Branson so she can have some laughter in her life, some happiness, and be next to me and her grandkids.
You were this before you went. You were already thinking about laughter as a therapeutic thing.
Well, I always probably did, but this was just because it's my family and it's somebody. And I always paid attention to my parents laughing. When they were laughing, the balance was there, very good balance was there. So when Dad passed away, I knew that I needed to take on that role to balance my mom out. And she was really depressed because she wanted to be next to my dad, and he was in Los Angeles, she was in Branson. And so after about a year of her kind of grieving and saying, let's go back, I want to visit his grave, I said, Mom, here's what I think we should do. We should bring Dad here to Branson.
Yeah.
He won't care. Right? So right. That way you can go visit him once a week or whenever you want to, and he'll be right here. So that's what we did. Wow. We moved, yeah. So
was he like a mausoleum kind of thing, or was he in the ground?
In the ground, oof. Yeah, in the ground. And so I sent people from Branson, from the cemetery. They knew what they were doing, and they brought the body there, and we reburied him and did the ceremony and planted a tree. So she was, for years, she would go there and sit under the tree, and it was kind of comforting for her. So perhaps maybe something, I'm still looking at the formula for laughter is meeting the other person's need. If you can identify what her needs are, because sometimes
she'll... Just now back to the mom here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we just feel they drive me crazy. But what is her need? Because for my parents, they were driving me crazy when we came to America. They don't speak English. They don't know. And so I literally had to think, when my career started taking off, I bought an apartment building on Doheny and Pico. And the reason I did that, because they could collect rents. My dad could fix
purpose.
Exactly,
yeah.
Purpose.
Yeah.
And that gave them at least probably 10 extra years.
So if we were guessing, we don't know this woman.
Right.
Purpose is an important thing.
Very much
meaning,
so.
Meaning, purpose.
Yes. You're lost without it.
Yeah.
So the needs, and maybe with this awareness, the gentleman can start kind of paying attention to what are the needs that need.
Fair enough. What else you got?
Hi, guys. This is Chris from Westchester, New York. Let me start by saying that although I am a mommy by day, I am definitely a daddy after dark.
Right. Ooh, listen, well, daddies, stop there. I want that on a t-shirt. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Huh, all right.
Daddy after dark, there
yeah.
you go.
Wow, okay. Or it should be dad after dark, right? Or daddy.
No, daddy.
Okay, all right, daddy.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. This is Chris from Westchester, New York. Let me start by saying that although I am a mommy by day, I am definitely a daddy after dark.
Nice.
And speaking of daddies, my double D slut wife is entering her third trimester with our first kid, who's a boy. And the topic of circumcision came up. And I am circumcised, but I think the procedure is archaic and pointless. And she goes with the hygiene argument. But honestly, I think she just doesn't want to peel back the foreskin when washing. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts one way or the other. Thank you very much. Bye.
Jakob, do you want to answer that? I've got a lot to say. I've got a bunch to say.
Oh, boy.
Did the Soviet government allow circumcision?
They did not.
Did not allow it.
But some people did it anyway. Mm. So, yeah. No, they did not. Mm. Yeah.
Even if...
No. Mm. There was no heritage. No.
Right.
So yeah. However... I kind of tried to figure this out. Why? What's the significance of that?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting piece of literature, there was a book, I don't want to butcher it, I think it was Money, Power, and Sex or something like that, written by a surgeon. And his theory was that their circumcision started with the Jewish women liking circumcised penis because it was in your pants getting roughed up, so they would not be as sensitive and not orgasm as quickly.
As easily. That's interesting.
Right.
Interesting idea.
So again, this is just...
Well, let me give a couple of pieces.
Yeah.
Worldwide, it is considered a very important intervention for prevention of AIDS, herpes, STDs, warts, and penile cancer, and cervical cancer. So there's an international push to get lots more circumcision done. Because the men that are circumcised... less likely to, particularly to get HIV and HPV. And when you don't have access to other preventative measures, that is something that you can do that it materially affects the transmission of these sometimes life-threatening sexually transmitted diseases. So the Centers for Disease Control and the various giant health organizations massively pushing for this internationally. Secondly, there's something called phimosis, which you have never seen. And phimosis is extremely unpleasant. I thank God I was circumcised by my parents. Phimosis is a narrowing of the prepuce, of the skin in front of the penis. It's very common. And if a slight tear in it causes scarring, and then it scars more, and the head of the penis cannot get through. And that is extremely problematic. That is the leading, here, I'm going to show pictures right here, the leading cause for the need, this phimosis there on the, leading cause for the need for circumcision is adulthood, and it is no fun. Then the only way to get the head of the penis out is to tear the prepuce. And it's just a mess. It's a total mess. And these are very common. And so avoiding all that to me seems like massively important. And adult circumcision is not fun.
Right.
And childhood circumcision, it's done with anesthesia. Child doesn't feel a thing. They're even racked anymore the way they anesthetize things. So come on now.
When you said that this is going to be traumatizing.
This whole experience? Right, watch out for your phimosis. Don't want you getting any phimosis because the Soviets were so difficult with you. You got any other voice messages there for us?
What's up? This is Lenny. I don't know if balls are supposed to be this sensitive, but man, the term when chicks say don't, you know, in those porn videos, don't leave out the balls, don't forget the balls. You can leave mine out because I don't know, man. I got something going where it's not even slightly enjoyable. These chicks, you know, touch them a little too aggressively. Even just a little bit is just too much. So
I feel for you.
I don't know.
I do too.
Them out. I definitely have, you know, some kind of lump on both sides. But I think that just might be the epididymis.
Might be.
The only reason,
yep,
I know that is because I ripped mine off when I was younger.
What?
All the way. So I was just wondering.
I want to hear that story. He ripped off his epididymis. That means he had to tear his testy out of the scrotum and tear off the top part of it. Oh,
wow.
Man. That's the kind of thing. I don't know if he's going to tell us or not, but that's the kind of thing people get from like falling on their bike handlebars and things like that.
Yeah, or yeah, firecracker accident
no,
or something.
No, no, it's like you had to come down hard.
Ah, got it.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering, you know, I feel the string that goes down connects to each ball, but it's really, really sensitive, almost painful. So I'm just curious as to if this is normal or if I should hit up my doctor. So thank you.
It's okay. I'm guessing it has something to do with the residual trauma from you tearing off your epididymis, which is extraordinary. I on Loveline once, a guy called in and said that he had a bike accident. And he rode behind a like a big billboard, and there was blood, and he looked in, and his testicle had fallen out of the scrotum, pushed it back in, and went about his business, didn't want to tell his parents, he was too afraid. This is the male brain.
Wow.
It'll
wow
get better if it doesn't
yeah
kill
nobody
me
will know. Yeah,
if it
yeah
doesn't
nobody
kill me,
it's
I'll be all
like
right.
Chernobyl, right? Chernobyl. Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That was absolutely his personal Chernobyl, for sure. That was Chernobyl. So anyway, I would advise you get that looked at just because you have had surgery and you're having sensitivity and stuff like that. But a lot of guys are very sensitive, so good on you. All right, so I'm going to read this one about healthier relationships. I have no idea what...
Okay, okay.
Longtime fan, excited you teamed up with YMH. Taste of Loveline again, which is this show. Don't know what you did right to deserve cool guys like you and Tom. I was raised by a single mother. I have a history of addiction and mental illness in my family. Bipolar disorder. Lucky for me, I have no interest in drugs or alcohol, so he didn't get the gene. The only mental illness I suffer from is high-functioning generalizing anxiety. However, more noticeably, I've got some attachment issues to work on. Been trying to grow out of codependent, people-pleasing habits, right? I often find myself in abusive relationships with narcissists. Interesting. Give all my time and money and affection waiting on these men. This is a woman. I'm super independent when it comes to work and money, but there's something missing that keeps me with these men that just use and abuse me. Any advice? Okay. So probably she had a narcissistic parent and probably dad. Mm-hmm. And that has her sort of love map is the attachment to somebody like that. And you can do two things, in my humble opinion. One is to, whenever you are super attracted to a guy, we're perfect instruments with our attractions. Our attractions are just absolutely perfect. If you have a trauma in your childhood and it puts you into a pattern of repeating that trauma with your relationships, you'll do it every time. We're perfect. And it causes us to be attracted to these people. And so what we always tell people is, if you feel lightning bolts, that's another narcissist. I don't know. I don't care if it's a narcissist that doesn't look like a narcissist. If you feel lightning bolts and that's been your pattern, what we just read here, it's another one. Think butterflies, not lightning bolts. In other words, go for guys that are not quite so alluring. They'll still be kind of narcissistic, but they may not be that brand of narcissist that is abusive to you, which is what you seem to have intense attraction for. It's really kind of love addiction also. You might want to read, she's a reader, might want to read Pia Melody's book, Overcoming Love Addiction, I think it's called. That would also help you. I know you read, she said here that she read Codependent No More. But what we'd recommend for you is therapy, because therapy then changes the attachment, changes your relationship in the therapeutic process. So you then take that out into the world and you're not so bound by these narcissistic folks. How's that sound?
Sounds good. I have an idea also that I think it's accurate what you're describing. And I also see that most people are unaware that there are three kinds of relationships. There's dependent relationship, which seems mm-hmm. like what she's attracting. Mm-hmm. There's independent relationship, excuse me, that kind of a new model that two people are earning a good living and they're living together. And the challenge is this: in the codependent relationship, there is a lot of polarity, sexual polarity, even though it's painful in the end, but it's sexual polarity. That movie was Sleeping with an Enemy, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of a drama.
Intensity.
Yes. And so what, in my opinion, what was happening, that was an old model of the relationship. And then starting in the 1940s, women said, no more of this. And they were able to go to work during the time when the war was there, and they were appreciated and acknowledged, and they felt empowered. So when men came back, they wanted to go back to that codependent relationship, and women chose not to. A lot of women didn't. Mm-hmm. And so then it created that independent relationship. And in that scenario, what happens, the sexual polarity is very low. They're not attracted to one another. They're more like roommates. They could be good business partners, mm-hmm. but they're not really at each other with passion. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there's a third stage, which is where I was taking my dissertation, is that law of laughter indicates that when you are independent, you can't get into that being codependent and jump over. And I call it co-supportive. Mm. And this is when both people understand the needs of the other person and they're willing to meet their needs. At Perfect. That point, yeah. you become complementary opposites, and then sense of humor creates the laughter. So just another opportunity to be aware that just because you're attracting that doesn't mean that there's no other model. It's just we're not aware of that.
Mutuality. Let's do one more voicemail.
What's up, Dr. Drew? This is Marcos.
Marcus.
And just calling to see if you get diarrhea when you smoke too much nicotine.
Nicotine?
I vape. It's only nicotine, really. Huh. I don't smoke cigarettes. And yeah, I get some pretty gnarly diarrhea. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the nicotine dose can be pretty high, and it's a stimulant. So they used to use nicotine. They used caffeine as a laxative back in the day, and I'm sure nicotine did the same thing. So yeah, that makes sense. Why don't you back off? Come on, man. Don't you see the commercials where it says nicotine is poison?
It can kill you?
Well, it won't do that.
No.
Nicotine, the people confuse tobacco and nicotine.
Oh.
Tobacco is what kills you. The nicotine in the vape is not that big a deal. But developmentally, it might have some effects we don't know about yet. We're still trying to figure that out. But there's all this moral outrage because, oh my God, we found a way around tobacco with nicotine. And people spend their whole life on nicotine gum.
And it's okay.
It's fine.
Interesting.
Well,
I wonder if you getting circumcision while you're smoking.
Vaping?
And, yeah.
And having diarrhea? I don't think that's a good combination. No. It's just guessing.
Yeah, just a thought.
So where can people see you? What do you want people to know? Where
I want, here's what my social media people saying. that you need to get more followers on Twitter. Okay. Now, I left the Soviet Union because I didn't want to be followed.
No,
right?
I get that. Yes.
I didn't.
Yes.
And now I'm saying, please follow me.
Yes.
It's Yakov _ Smirnov on Twitter. There you go.
There you go. Please follow Yakov. You won't be sorry. And are you putting up jokes there? You're going to keep me entertained?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. All right. I don't think I'm following you. Let me see. Am I? Right now, I'm going to make an effort.
Yes, Yakov _ Smirnov.
At, let's get this. Yakov. There it is. Follow. This is you, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, awesome.
Still with American flags all over the place.
Got one follower. Yay.
Done.
What a country.
All right.
Yes.
All right, my friend. And where else? Give me any other places?
Yakov at Yakov.com.
Is there any touring or anything? Or
yeah, Branson? Yeah. I'm going to be in Branson July 4th through July 13th. And then again back at my theater in Branson on October 14th through December 10th.
Otherwise, you're out here?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm good. Doing Comedy Store regularly and on Friday nights.
Well,
I
great.
Do it just to keep in shape.
Yeah.
And I do some touring, but not a lot. So I was getting my doctorate degree.
I
so
know.
Now I'm kind of interested in doing more lectures on the socialism. I call it Ghost of Socialism Past, Present, and Future.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I'm doing first one this Wednesday at Santa Monica College, 100 people in the...
You should record it.
Yeah, I will.
As a podcast.
Yeah, yeah, I will. I definitely...
I would love to listen to that.
It will be happening, and there's a lot of interest about this because I'm in a unique position that I live there. And when I watch like Chernobyl, I go, I know what happened.
And the craziness is everyone today goes, oh, and we'll do it differently.
No.
That's always what history has taught us. People say that.
Because it's human nature we're going to. Because when you have groupthink happening, which is a lot of this political correctness is heading that way, and then the Twitter and the Facebook, they become like, it's like
mobs.
A mob.
Mobs, yeah.
Mob.
It is mob.
And mob, when it's organized the right way, which was not, it's the wrong way, really, but Lenin did it, and then Stalin did it, and they organized them up. The same people who were fighting for betterment of people in Russia were turning into being murderers, and killing millions and millions of people. And it's always in the name of in betterment of human race.
And it, you know, then the what's the word?
The balance.
Well, no, what the Hegel always talked about, the antithesis was a synthesis, antithesis sort of conflict, was labor and management, right?
That
was
sort of
their
control.
Now it is white empowerment versus everybody else. And so we've left the labor management diathesis behind.
But it's the same thing. It's that 1% that there are people who are not putting maybe as much energy in creating that wealth. They're looking at these people who are rich and they're saying, we want to share this. Yeah. We want to get that, right?
Yeah.
And those people who have the wealth are saying, I don't think so. That's our money. And, you know, and so the only way to do it, you have
that's
to...
That's the same thing that was going on in Russia, right?
That's what happened. Yeah, the czars had all the power and the money, and then the people didn't have anything.
Yeah.
And then when Lenin organized them and got from Germany weapons, they destroyed the czars. They destroyed the country for years. And anybody who had a little bit more, we're talking about... If these people had a piece of land with a pig on it or whatever, they were the bourgeois. They were supposed to be killed by people who didn't have that.
Right.
And that's how it spread.
So how could it be done right?
I think that this society is the best so far in terms of keeping that balance of left, keeping the right from going too far and destroying all the environment and global warming and all of that. And then the right is there to say, guys, you're gonna kill us. It's like driving on this cliff where you have on one side and the other side abyss, and this could happen on either side. So having
keep the balance.
Keep the balance.
Is that gonna be the point of your talk?
Pretty much so. Because you can, this country, it just, we stop talking to each other. And because there is no conversation, we can't find a rational way to say, okay, how do we really solve this productively? So maybe people should be retrained there. Everybody's worried about the truck drivers that are not going to have jobs. Well, this is the time to think about this. How can we retrain them so they can be productive, creative people, which made America what it used to be, is a producer, and then we became consumers. And the only people going to produce is Chinese.
Well, we'll look for that socialism, past, present, and future.
Yes.
And I thank you for being here, my friend.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you again soon. And we all thank you as well. Didn't know we were going to get into politics, but here we are. Why not? It's after dark.
Wait, but it was right after circumcision. So
yeah,
it's
you're
fine.
Right. It's after phimosis and socialism.
Yes. Yeah.
Somehow socialism and phimosis are sort of in the same breath. We'll see you next time.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation of the Dr. Drew After Dark podcast or interaction on the DrDrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or physician medical advice or direction per se. You must always follow your medical professional's advice and direction. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Please understand, I am not playing the role of physician in this environment per se. I'm educating. I am a licensed physician with specialty boards in American Board of Internal Medicine and American Board of Addiction Medicine.